Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome back to the New Books in Indian Religions podcast, a podcast channel here on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Dr. Raj Balkaran. More importantly, I have today the pleasure of introducing to you Dr. Ruth Vanita, who is professor at the University of Montana. We'll be speaking about a fascinating brand new OUP publication called The Dharma of Justice in the Sanskrit Epics. Ruth, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
If I'm not mistaken, we both contributed to the Indian philosophy and gender, Bloomsbury Handbook.
Right. Alvina Howard edited it. Yes.
Yes. Alvina Howard. So it's nice to connect a name and a face. And I look forward to diving into this fascinating book. Tell us a little bit about the backstory. What prompted you to write this book? Why another book on the Mahabharata? What's the story about this book?
Well, I want this to be for general readers. I mean, scholars too, but also general readers. And I try to write in a style that's accessible to everyone. And I feel that the Mahabharata and Ramayana are often dismissed as Brahmanical, patriarchal, et cetera. Whereas in fact, they deal with issues that are being discussed right now. And it's remarkable how they address some of these that you would never think of. Like, for example, the question of, is it unkind to take away milk from the calf and drink it? So this is what vegans talk about now, right? Just questions like that, or questions of consent. How do you decide to consent to us, what does consent consist of, friendship and family, lots of things. So what I'm looking at specifically is debates in the text between different kinds of people. And these people are from all varnas, different genders, different age groups, and they are discussing a range of issues related to life, issues about varna, gender, and species difference, and questions of justice related to these differences. And also other issues come up along with that, like disability, like age, like revenge, like power, and so on and so forth. Yeah.
You know, we cover a great many different types of monographs and collected volumes on the podcast. My dharma as podcast host, as it were, is to look at the merits of them all in a mode that befits a more general audience. In this particular case, I'll have to resist the temptation to get into the nuts and bolts too much, because of course the Mahabharata is a great love and object of study. Sanskrit narrative is where I live. Is it fair to say that what you say about current issues being reflected in the Mahabharata adds credence to the dictum stated in the Mahabharata twice, that what is not in the Mahabharata is nowhere at all? Let's talk a little bit. I'm sure the vast majority of our audience will be familiar either from their own heritage or from studies or in passing, will be familiar on some level with the Mahabharata. I think of it as an epic text. Do you want to say a little bit about how you consider the Mahabharata? How do you regard the Mahabharata? And a follow-up question, feel free to address this in whatever order or fashion you see fit, is Would you say it's fair to say I sometimes describe the Mahabharata in continuing studies, teaching settings, as something along the lines of almost a conference of ideas, a debates, that it preserves conversation? You know, would you address some of these ideas?
Yes, it certainly, of course, is that. It's dialogic, and it's remarkable how many different kinds of people enter into these debates, not just sages, but all kinds of people. And also, I think I see it as a sort of treasure house from which people across centuries have drawn what they wanted to conduct debates of their own. My last chapter is on the Bhakta poets, who are often still seen as if they are revolting against an Upanishadic tradition, whereas I think I demonstrate that many of them, Kabir, Tulsidas, Rahim, Raidas, Meera, they are drawing from the epics and the Purans basic ideas of consciousness, ideas of life and death and rebirth, ideas also of justice, ideas of gender justice and species and how we should treat animals and all of these things, and weaving them into their poems. That's how I view it. And of course, we know that the stories are told and retold, but I'm also looking at it as a treasure house of ideas, not just stories, which is what very often I'm asked to talk about Hindu mythology. And I don't use that word mythology, but stories are important, but I think ideas are very important too.
Without question. And then there are crazy folks like myself who like to distill ideas in stories. But yes, the interplay between narrative and philosophy is certainly rich in the Mahabharata. Say a word about which text or texts or translations you primarily draw on.
Primarily, of course, Sukthankar, but I also look at the Southern Recension, because Sukthankar does leave out some moments that have become over time sort of crucial, as everybody knows, like Draupadi crying out to Krishna, praying to Krishna when she's being disrobed, for example. So, yeah.
So for those listening, we've had other podcasts on the idea of the production of critical editions. We had a podcast, for example, on the Skanda Purana project that is ongoing, and we've talked about the Mahabharata and the critical edition thereof. So Dr. Vinita is saying that she's relied primarily on the critical edition, but one of the boons of the critical edition is that it's sort of this reconstituted text hypothesis of well, there's much to be. I'm not going to finish that sentence because it'll depend on who you speak to as to whether or not such a text could have ever existed. But whatever was excised was left in the critical apparatus. And so she's looked at some important episodes in the critical apparatus of the critical edition. And were there particular translations? I know you mentioned this in the book, but just for the sake of those listening, were there particular translations that you drew?
I look at Ganguly, whom I use Ganguly, which I like very much. Basically, I like Ganguly very much, even though it's an old edition, but the language is a little
archaic.
But it still, I think, is very good. And then I also looked at Bibek Debroy. Those are the main two. Then I looked at some others as well.
What would you say, if you had to distill it, what is the central thrust or theme of the book? We'll talk about the specific chapters. It's rich, without question, but what is the central overarching thrust or argument?
The central argument is that there have been debates from ancient times to modern times, continuing debates about justice with regard to gender, with regard to Varna, with regard to the Dharma, and that Dharma is also, not only, but also about justice with regard to gender, Varna, and species. And my final conclusion, one of my final conclusions is that animals, kindness to non-human animals is not total non-violence, but non-cruelty and kindness to non-human animals is the dharma that is foundational. And is also, my argument is that it is the dharma most available to all. So when one is relatively powerless, poor, etc., one may not have the ability to perform many other kinds of dharma or justice because one doesn't have the power. But almost every human being can be either kind or unkind to some animal, bird, insect, etc. And that is the dharma that's available to all.
Now, in this context, when you use or think of the term justice, do we mean here social equality, or how might we think of justice in this context?
That is also a matter of debate in the text, because Yudhishthira, for example, is always looking for some extent for equality and equity. And then total equality is, of course, not possible. But it's a question of doing the right thing in the, and I think the texts are not trying to come up with some universal deontological principles. They are trying to, the texts are trying to look at each situation and see what can best be done there, in with all the constraints that the individuals there in each situation face, what you can do, which is the kindest thing to everyone concerned.
So there's certainly this emphasis on situational ethics that's so colorfully and brilliantly crafted in the Mahabharata, with these impossible situations where paragons of virtue have to do questionable things, and that is the best possible path. But you mentioned in passing just now that in the Mahabharata, do we see, let me phrase it as a question, do we see a universalist ethics? Do we see sort of imperatives that, even if for the sake of lip service, are lauded in the Mahabharata?
Well, it's for us to draw out, and of course we can come to very different conclusions. But yes, I think even what seems like an impossible situation, we wouldn't be able to relate to it. I teach the Gita, and we wouldn't be able to relate to it if it were not that our own situations have some relationship to that situation. The impossible is actually just a heightening of possible situations. The contrast between the conflict, for example, that Arjuna faces between doing the right, fighting, engaging in violence that is going to affect his family. That's something that all of us, we don't have to fight a physical battle usually. Sometimes we do, as in the American Civil War, for example. But we often have to fight other type of conflicts when the family will get upset. What will people say if you do this, if you do that? And so there are these conflicts, right? Or the question of, say, taking revenge, similarly, or changing sex, or the dharma of parenting, or a ruler. Should a ruler be completely nonviolent, which Yudhishthira wants to be? And is that even possible or desirable? Is that when you're nonviolent, is there inherent violence sometimes to other people whom you're not considering, as Yudhishthira very often is trying to be nonviolent to others, to his enemies, and in the process inflicting, I argue, a kind of violence on his family. So,
In your view, I mean, there's so much. I'm trying to stay in the lane of podcast host for public access. But in your view, this central, it's next to impossible to say that the Mahabharata has a central character, but certainly Yudhishthira's journey is very much crucial to the central tale. Why do you think the epic has Yudhishthira always struggling with violence or wanting to take the nonviolent path? What do you think this is about?
Well, he's one type of person, isn't he? He's one type of tendency that we all have to some extent, and one type of person who has an excessive predilection for this tendency. It's also to do with the fact that he has to be ruler. It's also to do with the fact, I argue, that he's the oldest son and a bit spoiled and likes to sort of be self-indulgent, like in a different way Duryodhana does. He's always threatening to commit suicide, but he never does so. I don't see him as the central character. Everybody is struggling. Arjuna is also struggling. Of course, in the Gita with violence. My first chapter is on the Gita. I see Arjuna and Krishna together, which many people do, Suthankar does too, as the central characters. I mean, the central character of characters. They are, in a sense, one and in a sense two. So
perhaps it'll be fruitful, because the chapters are so rich. Perhaps we'll go through chapter by chapter and you could say a word or two about the central argument or the episode that you're looking at. So as you mentioned, after the introductory chapter, the first substantive chapter is about Arjuna and Krishna. And so what do you point to or argue in that chapter?
I'm looking at that section which is about gender, which is not usually paid, to which a lot of attention is usually not paid. When Arjuna says that if we fight this battle and there are no men left for the women to marry, then women will be degraded by marrying people outside the Varna and the other clan, and then everything, the whole social order will fall to pieces. Now, Krishna doesn't ever directly, this is where women are involved centrally and gender's involved. Krishna doesn't explicitly answer the question. He doesn't say do this or do that because this is this. But he does, I think, in a wider sense, answer that question, which is that you can't decide who other people will marry, which Arjuna as a patriarch has a tendency to want to decide not only in the present, but in the future, what women will do in the future. Nobody can control that, as many other elements in the Mahabharata show that. The basic point that you can only do what you can do. You can't control how other people will respond to that, right? And that is up to them. You don't even know exactly what is going to happen. You can't predict. It's a mistake to think you can predict what will happen. I call the title is, the chapter is Arjuna and Krishna Friends Discuss the Family. And it's about Arjuna's tendency, which is, I think, a common tendency of all of us, to think that the family is the most important thing in the world, the family and along with that, the community. But I think Krishna is suggesting a different perspective whereby something else is more important. And I think perhaps that can be called friendship in a larger sense, a friendship between the divine and the human, friendship for all beings, the one who cares about the welfare of all beings, that is perhaps more important than just the family narrowly conceived.
The following chapter engages a fascinating question, a debate that perhaps is very much alive today, the question of Varna. And the title itself, I believe, yes, the title is Varna, defined by birth or by action. So what do you point to or argue in that chapter?
Then I just look at debates. I primarily look at two things. One is debates between different characters on this question. Is Varna something defined by birth or by action? There's that, of course, famous debate between the butcher, the guy who sells meat, and learned Brahman. And there's a debate between, a less looked at debate between a grocer, a baniya, and a Vaishya, and again, a scholarly Brahman. And at the end of these debates, basically the Brahmin says, you are a Brahmin right now because of action. You, even the person who is selling meat and something which is looked down upon, you are a Brahmin right now because of your knowledge and the way you are approaching your dharma and your action, right? So that's, then there are other debates. So that's what I look at. And then I look at characters in the text, primarily Vidura. Vidura, who I think is the most virtuous character in the text and the touchstone of virtue throughout. So I said Krishna and Arjuna at the center, but in another way, Vidura is another axis. And those three together, Krishna, Arjuna and Vidura, constitute the kind of the center, moral center of the text, and especially Vidura, who has great moral courage at various points in the text, who stands up for the right thing and faces a lot of disapprobation for that, but he doesn't mind. He does it anyway. And he's not self-seeking. He is cheerful. He has been very unjustly treated because he should have been king and would have been a very good king. But he doesn't live in a state of resentment. And he is the embodiment of dharma, basically. But he is what would be considered later as absolutely the so-called lowest varna, because, or no varna at all, because he is a product of intermarriage between varnas, right? And which many of the characters are, in a way, of relationships, intervarna relationships. And that I talk about that as well, that is there any such thing as pure varna? And then I look at Yudhishthira's wonderful argument, once or twice, an argument that he makes, which I really love. And this is what I mean by the modernity of the text, where he says there is no such thing as pure varna. What is anybody of? How do we know that anybody belongs to any varna? And this here, he's kind of, the Kama Sutra kind of echoes this same idea that who has sex, where, when, and how, who knows? That's what the Kama Sutra says. And Yudhishthira says something very similar when he says, all men and all women, and many of them are having sex with each other all the time. We don't know what they are doing, and this is quite true, right? So you you think that you come from this pure Varna where everybody belongs to the same Varna. But no, that's not the case at all. And we know that before DNA and even after DNA testing, we don't exactly, they certainly didn't exactly know who was which man's child. And so where is the question of perfect purity? There isn't. There isn't any such question of perfect purity. Everything is mixed. And
So using Vidura as a case study, and I think there's a compelling argument to be made there. What would you say? What is the Mahabharata saying that he is virtuous? He is brahmanical. He is you know, is the Mahabharata critiquing his low social standing, or how would you reconcile his social standing with his moral standing in terms of what the Mahabharata is trying to teach us?
It's basically saying that it's a mistake to think that people's virtue depends on dharma, depends on their varna, because Duryodhana belongs to a so-called higher varna, and certainly he does it, or Dushasana, various people like that, and many of them, Shakuni, etc. And Vidura is an example, not the only example. There's also Sanjaya the charioteer, a major characters. The name Sanjaya is still a very popular boy's name, not for no reason. I mean, he is one of the exponents of dharma. So Vidura is also somebody who teaches dharma. He's not just embodying it. At various times, he actually teaches the king dharma. He gives lectures about it. So does Sanjaya. So throughout the text. So they are among the major exponents of dharma. So it's basically saying that so-called Shudras can teach dharma, and they do teach dharma, and they also practice dharma. And it's not about being Brahmanical at all. It is about dharma is something that is available to everyone, looking, doing the right thing, looking after your parents, your friends, standing up for the right, for the truth, etc. These are things everybody can do. And both Vidura and Sanjaya and others are examples of this. So the text is showing that, is demonstrating that. Also, it is demonstrating how other people treat him. When I said touchstone of virtue, how other people treat him shows you something about them. Duryodhana is very contemptuous of him, and that shows you something about Duryodhana. Krishna chooses to go and eat in Vidura's house and with Vidura, and not to, and he says, I'll eat the pure food of Vidura and not the banquet that Duryodhana is offering. And he also takes the food from Vidura's house and distributes it to Brahma before they eat. Okay, so this tells you about something about the practices of the time, and also what Krishna thinks the practice should be and how he practices. Right.
Well, it's a beautiful illustration of this. You know, from the perspective of orthodoxy, it's subversive in terms of caste purity in that perspective. But what this is saying is that what that episode that you bring up with eating with Vidura is saying that no, he is the Brahmana by disposition. It's his offering is pure because he's got the more Shuddha samskaras, not someone who happens to be born in a lineage with it. Fascinating. The next chapter is called Gender and the Dharmas of Singleness, Marriage, and Desire. What do you say in this chapter?
So the next two chapters kind of go together, so I'll talk about them together. This is my earlier work, Sulabha, on the female sage Sulabha, which I have kind of expanded here and looked at other aspects of this dialogue that she has with the philosopher King Janaka. So she's a female philosopher, she's a single woman, and there are various single women in the epics, and I look at the dialogues that precede the one that she has with Janaka. There are earlier dialogues as well, and she asked the question and this was something that sort of came to me by this reading. I've read that dialogue many times, which is, you know, what is a person, and what we call a person. In English, these words often get confused, person, individual, etc., etc. But in Sanskrit, and even in languages like Hindi, which derive from Sanskrit, like the word vyakti for person, a person is really an expression, vyakti, to vyakta, abhivyakta, abhivyakti. So it is just an expression. And as we know, an expression changes all the time. So a person is something transient. The way you express, the way it is expressed when you are 15 is different from the way when you are 60, right? And a person is only for this lifetime. It is transient. And everything that pertains to the person is including gender. So everything that pertains to the being, including gender, is also transient and constantly changing. And I also, sorry, I got a bit confused here. So 4, 5, and 6 kind of go together, because I also look at a debate between Ashtavakra, a sage Ashtavakra, and another female sage called Disha, older female sage. And he's basically going to get married, and he's sent to talk to her about marriage and desire. And she makes advances to him, and he has to sort of think about this. And when he first sees her, he thinks she's old and ugly. So he's very easy for him to refuse this engagement. But later, when she gives him a massage and feeds him good food and he starts getting attracted, then he realizes there is a different kind of beauty that she has. And then she appears to him to be young and beautiful. And then he has more difficulty resisting, but he still decides to resist because he's already engaged to another woman. And so it's a test for him, but she's also teaching him something about desire. Because when he starts off, he's very austere and very ascetic. And he says, or he thinks he is, and he says, I only want to get married to have children. And I don't want to I have no desire for anything at all, which the text shows is not true at all, is not true. He does experience desire, and he has to deal with this desire and not just say, no, I never experienced desire. So that is something she teaches him about marriage. And she also it also shows that an older woman who is unmarried can experience desire. Older people do experience desire. She's an old woman, she's single, but she feels desire. And she talks about the different, about marriage, that marriage, she may not be able to produce children. We can guess because she's shown as old. We can't say for sure because she's a bit of an enchantress, and maybe that is just a disguise. But she does say that she does show that marriage can be for attraction and for fulfilling. She says that she has an affection for him, an attraction for him, and she can offer him her hand in marriage. And he says, no, 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 how can a woman do that? A woman has to be under the protection of our father, husband, or brother. So how can you be independent to just propose marriage? And she says, no, I can. I've always been independent. All this wealth is mine, you can have it. So she basically proposes marriage. And so here I would say that that famous or notorious line from the Manusmriti, often quoted out of context, that a woman has to be under protection of a husband, father, or brother, a son, sorry, is demonstrated in the text, in the epics, not just here, but several times, to be incorrect just because of reality. And as I said, the theory is disproved by reality. The reality is there are single women. There were single women in the text, and there always have been single women. And if there is a single woman who grows old, then she's not going to have a father, a husband, or a son, or maybe even a brother. And so she is going to be independent and make her own decisions, right? So that was that part of the text, yeah.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Fascinating. So the next chapter you wanted to talk about probably would be, because you covered a couple in that section. So the next one, I believe, was revenge, forgiveness, and gender crossing, correct?
Yeah, so chapters 5 and 6 are about Sulabha and Janaka, and about, that's where the whole question of consent comes in, because Janaka is attracted to Sulabha when he first sees her. He's a married man and a king, and she is a female philosopher. Again, he can't believe that a single woman is roaming around and making her own decisions. And he says, no, no, whom do you belong to? And you can't be independent, but she is. And then when he realizes that, he thinks some other king must have sent her here to entrap him. So he can't believe that a single woman would just want to come and have a philosophical debate with him, he thinks that some king is sending her some kind of poison maiden. You know, there's that image of the idea of the poison maiden. He actually uses the image of poison, and that I realize that that is what he is referring to, the Vishakanya. He thinks that she's a tool of some other king who has come here to entrap him. And he feels attracted to her, but he blames her for that attraction and that she is enticing him. So all of these things are handled in the text. And Sulabha retains the high ground. She speaks in a very dignified manner. She doesn't get into all these things, but she demonstrates that speech. She basically demonstrates that his speech is not elegant. It is not the right way to speak. It's not expected from a philosopher. And she demonstrates in her own speech how one should have a philosophical debate. Then the next two chapters, 7 and 8, are basically about Shikhandin and the whole question of rebirth. And what I found fascinating in this is that Amba, who is reborn as Shikhandini, and then as from being Shikhandini, changes, has a sex change within one lifetime and becomes Shikhandin. The rebirth question was very interesting to me because it was fascinating to me to realize that this is a great study of rebirth, because the earlier lady, Amba, had to deal with a lot of things. She had to struggle with a lot of things, with marriage and with the man whom she wanted refusing to marry her, and then being unable to marry, and with feelings of revenge and anger and all of this. And she committed suicide in order to be reborn as a man and to take revenge. But then Shikhandini, she's reborn as Shikhandini, but Shikhandini doesn't have an easy time. All of that earlier karma and attachment is sort of, as it were, carried over. This is not stated by the text, but by reading the narrative, we can see this, that Shikhandini too deals with all these issues, with revenge and with anger and with marriage issues and being a daughter of a king and how to deal with marriage and all of that. So the same thing in different forms comes back. Also, Shikhandini is born into a family that is driven by revenge. She's Drupada's daughter and the sister of Draupadi, both characters who are driven by revenge. And Shikhandini wants to take revenge on Bhishma. She doesn't know why. The interesting thing is she doesn't remember that she was Amba in a previous birth. Nowhere does Shikhandini mention that. Other people know it. Bhishma knows it, but Shikhandini herself and Shikhandin, when she becomes Shikhandin, never mentioned that that is the reason to kill Bhishma. She just has this rage and this desire to kill Bhishma. And it's a great description of how we sometimes feel. We have these unexplained feelings, and the typical Indian explanation for unexplained feelings when you fall in love at first sight or you dislike somebody at first sight is to say that this must be from a previous birth, right? And it's a great demonstration of that, because she just hates Bhishma and wants to kill him for no particular reason in this birth, but we know as the readers that it's from the former birth. Then I also looked at Shikhandin's masculinity. Shikhandin's masculinity is very different. I mean, there are various kinds of masculinity in the text. Shikhandin is driven by rage, and this produces a certain kind of masculinity. And I go into the details of this. Now, there have been feminist interpretations saying that Shikhandin is some kind of embodiment of the goddess, because the name Amba means a goddess. And therefore, Shikhandin is some sort of embodiment of the goddess trying to kill Bhishma. And some feminist critics have even said Bhishma is kind of the worst patriarch and demonic and this and that, which I totally don't agree with. I don't think Bhishma is the worst patriarch. You've got people like Duryodhana and Dushasana around. Obviously, he's not the worst. And also, Bhishma rules when he's ruling as a regent, as a king. He rules in close alliance with his stepmother, and who has actually deprived him of the kingship. But instead of resenting this, he consults her about everything. He's the only king who's shown doing that, deferring always to a woman. So I don't think he's the worst patriarch. He's not flawless or perfect, but he's I don't think he's demonic at all. In fact, I go into the language of the text to show that it is the Drupada family which tends to be more demonic, not all of them, but Shikhandin definitely is more than once called an embodiment, having taken on some attributes of a demon. And I looked very closely at the battles that Shikhandin fights, because Shikhandin doesn't fight only with Bhishma. And Shikhandin is really not the best warrior. He's consumed with rage and he keeps fighting these battles, but he doesn't perform as well as many of the other warriors do. And then, of course, as we know, he kills Bhishma, but basically under Arjuna's basically it's Arjuna who kills Bhishma, and by using Shikhandan as a shield. So it's not Shikhandan who actually kills Bhishma. And so I go into all those questions. But it's interesting, because in earlier work, I had looked at Shikhandan's sex change as being driven by marriage, which it is. Shikhandini is dressed up as a boy and married off to a woman, and then that creates a lot of trouble. And then Shikhandini becomes Shikhandan and remains Shikhandan. And the marriage is not repeated. So here you have an instance of a same-sex marriage, the marriage of two women, which when the woman becomes a man, that there's no remarriage, they remain married, right? So that first marriage is still valid, the marriage of the two women. But what is interesting is that unlike many other stories of what we would call transgender people, in the epics, this one is not really driven by love. There's no mention of love for the bride. There is rage is Shikhandini's and Shikhandan's overpowering emotion. Unlike, say, Bhangaswana, another person who changes from being a man to a woman and decides to stay being a woman, because Bhangaswana says that women are more affectionate and women have more sexual pleasure. So she would like to remain a woman and not become a man. But Shikhandan doesn't go into any of this. Shikhandan also doesn't have any interesting dialogues with anyone. There's just rage-filled dialogues with speeches thrown at Bhishma. But that's it. No interesting dialogue with anyone. No reconciliation with the enemy Bhishma after Bhishma is lying on his deathbed. No dialogue ever with Krishna or with anybody. There's nothing very interesting about this character apart from just being a sort of a killing machine. So yeah.
Definitely a fascinating character. Much to be said about Shikhandini. And the following chapter, what do you present?
The following one is called Gender and the Dharma of Parenting, and I look at sort of the different ways of parenting, specifically at Ashtavakra and his father. His father curses Ashtavakra when he's in the womb, and that is why Ashtavakra is born distorted in 8 places. And then Ashtavakra rescues his father from death. So without going into too many details, it basically suggests that one should not be angry with a child and treat a child like fling curses at a child, and the kind of damage and the injury, in this case, it's physical injury, which could be seen as symbolic of the emotional injury and damage that one can do to a child through words, because he doesn't hit Ashtavakra or injure him physically, but it's just through words, through this curse that this happens. And then when Ashtavakra releases his father from death through his intellect. And so this is an example of disability. Ashtavakra is what we would call a disabled person, but has tremendous intellect, and releases his father from death. And the father says, this is why parents have children. This is why fathers have sons, that the son outdoes the parent. So he acknowledges that a child can teach you something. And it was because he refused to acknowledge that when Ashtavakra was a child and was teaching him that something right, was correcting him, he was furious at being corrected and he cursed him. But and he learns from the story that yes, a child can outdo a younger person, can outdo an older person. So it questions this simplistic hierarchy of older people are always wiser than younger people, of parents or children, parents should never be corrected by children, and things like that.
It's certainly a fascinating story. It's there's so many stories, but it's one of my favorites. This ended up writing about it in a recent book called The Stories Behind the Poses, where there's literally a pose called Ashtavakrasana named after this character. Fascinating story. The next chapter, Citizens, Rulers, and Nonviolence. What do we learn in that chapter?
Well, that's where I go into two or three things. One is the way the citizens participate in choosing a ruler. I thought this was very interesting. The citizens actually come out into public spaces and talk about it when they have to choose between Yudhishthira and Duryodhana, and they have reasons for why they think Yudhishthira will be a better ruler, and Duryodhana is self-seeking and basically functions as this little clique of four with Karna and others, and they say that they want Yudhishthira to be the ruler. But Yudhishthira, instead of listening to them, gives up and goes off to the forest on 2 separate occasions, right? And Yudhishthira is always ready to go off to the forest, throw up his hands, give up, and is constantly threatening to also to commit suicide. He's constantly saying, I want to be an ascetic, or I want to just give up my life. And many other characters, Vidura, Krishna, finally even Dhritarashtra, have to dissuade him and tell him, no, your dharma is to be a ruler. It's a difficult thing to do, but you have to do it because that is your dharma. So one thing I talk about in this chapter is the citizen's role, how they have a role in choosing the ruler, but the ruler may or may not listen to their voice. And then I talk about Yudhishthira's predilection for nonviolence, which is excessive. And he has debates about this with Bhima, with Arjuna, with Krishna, Vidura, everybody. Even after listening to Bhishma teaches him at great length the dharma of a king. Yudhishthira, even after that, is again threatening to go after the forest and rolling on the ground and so on. So a lot of people spend a lot of energy trying to stop him from this kind of behavior, but he never really gets over it, not entirely. He never gets over it. It's just his personality. And interestingly, Duryodhana also frequently threatens suicide, not as frequently as Yudhishthira, but he also does, not for reasons of nonviolence, but just for reasons of feeling resentful and so on. And then I also talk about how Yudhishthira's presenting himself as a nonviolent character is not entirely true, because there is one amazing instance where he is extremely nasty and verbally violent to Arjuna. And he says to Arjuna, I wish you had never been born, just because Arjuna hasn't killed Karna along the time sequence that Yudhishthira thinks he should have killed him. So Arjuna does kill Karna, but later, and he left the battlefield to come and check on Yudhishthira, who was injured. And Yudhishthira is furious and says, what is the point? We are all waiting for you to kill Karna and you're not doing this. I'm burning up with rage because of Karna. So he wants Karna to be killed, and he imagines Karna's head lying, rolling on the ground and so on. So his feelings are not that nonviolent. And he also then, when he finds Arjuna hasn't done what he wants him to do, he says, you should not have been born. For a sibling to tell a younger sibling that he should not have been born is really quite something. So I go in some detail into examining this dialogue where Krishna finally steps in and reconciles them. Then I talk about the consequences of Yudhishthira's somewhat crazy behavior, like right at the end of the battle, when Duryodhana is the only warrior left alive on the other side, Yudhishthira suddenly, without consulting anyone, tells Duryodhana, you can pick any one of us, the five Pandavas, to fight with. You can pick the weapon, you can pick the person. And if you win, we will give you the entire kingdom back. Right? And at that point, many scholars too blame Krishna for doing what they think are unfair, for engaging in what they think are unfair tactics. And this is a good example, because then Krishna is furious with Yudhishthira, and he says, you have brought us back to the dice gambling table again, because again, you are doing something very foolish where you have made a bet. Basically, Yudhishthira is addicted to gambling, as several characters say. And this is a bet he is making with Duryodhana. Okay, you win this one battle and we'll give you back everything. So he's going to exile his brothers and himself to the forest again, leave the mother alone, leave the children alone. And Krishna says, how could you do this? And he really rebukes him, but now it's done. And that is why when Bhima is fighting with Duryodhana, Krishna tells him to hit Duryodhana's thighs and break them. Now this is breaking the laws of combat. And of course, the Kauravas have broken the laws of combat many times, except that they don't, they've tried to murder Bhima, they've tried to murder Arjuna, they've tried to murder all the Pandavas by burning them alive. So they've done many unjust things. They just don't agonize about it. The difference is that when Yudhishthira does anything, or the Pandavas in general do anything unjust, they agonize about it more, and Yudhishthira agonizes about it more. So that is what I'm saying is that Krishna has to tell Bhima to break Duryodhana's thighs, because Yudhishthira has placed them in this predicament where if Duryodhana wins, they'll all be exiled back to the forest again. So whereas Krishna is blamed for this, actually, I think Yudhishthira is more to blame for this, for making such a foolish bet.
So how educable is Yudhishthira?
Yeah, of course, there's a famous book called The Education of Yudhishthira. There's much talk about Yudhishthira being this wonderful. I'm surprised by how many scholars are so admiring of Yudhishthira. One tends to get more and more irritated with him throughout the text, at least I do. And I don't think he's tremendously educable. He's very self-centered. And I talk about the ending of the text, the absolute ending, where when the other Pandavas all fall one by one when they're walking up the mountains, Yudhishthira gives an explanation for each one's fall. And that explanation doesn't really is not in sync with what the text is saying, because Arjuna is in grief for Krishna. He's grieving for Krishna, and he grieves when his younger brothers Nakula and Sahadev fall, and therefore he gives up. But Yudhishthira says he has fallen because he gives up, a totally different expression, because he was over arrogant and he was arrogant. But that's not what the text is saying. So Yudhishthira gives these explanations, and finally Yudhishthira is tested when he's taken to a supposed underworld where he sees his brothers being tortured. They're not really being tortured, but he's shown that. And there, finally, he expresses some anger on behalf of his brothers. And he says, why is Duryodhana sitting in heaven? I don't want to be there with him. He was a bad person. I want to be with my brothers and my wife who are suffering, right? So there, finally, he expresses some violence in the right direction, some violent feelings, and some kindness in the right direction to his family. Whereas throughout the text, he's been kind of trying to function in the opposite way of being unjust to his immediate family and trying to be overly kind to the enemy, regardless of what the enemy is doing. So maybe he gets educated right at the very end, at that moment, I think.
So not particularly educable, I surmise, in your view.
Very hard to educate, but I think he...
Oh dear.
And everybody says that. It's not me saying that. Vyasa says that right up towards the end of the text. Vyasa says, what have we been all shouting all this time and throwing our words through the air, trying to teach you what the dharma of a king is? This is after Bhishma has spent like huge amount of time trying to educate him, and he's again saying that he wants to go off to the forest and be an ascetic. And Vyasa, who's the author of the text, finally uses his patience and says, what have all of us been flinging our words into the air for if you are still saying the same thing? And he says, you're behaving like a child in a childish manner, like behave like an adult. Yeah, Krishna says the same thing to him too.
There's so much to be said there that I won't, but we'll continue the conversation, I'm sure. The final substantive chapter is turning to animals, kindness to animals, the dharma most available to all. Tell us about this.
Yeah, here I just noticed that in every speech about dharma that anyone makes, all of them, in one way or the other, talk of sarva bhuta hite rataha. Being a person involved in dharma is one who is involved in the welfare of all beings. And we tend to forget, especially talking in English and living in the modern world, that sarva bhuta is not just humans. It includes all beings. And of course, the other beings outnumber humans if you take into account insects and so on. So being kind to all beings, that is the mark of a person who adheres to dharma, and includes a ruler. That's part of the ruler's dharma, to take care of the subjects, the people living in the territory, not just the people, but all beings. And so I look at various narratives and various dialogues which talk about this kindness to animals. And there's intensive debates about what does that really mean? When can you kill an animal? Should you eat animals? Should you other kinds of cruelty, overworking animals? There's this wonderful narrative of the bullocks being overworked, for example. Hunting is talked about in great detail by, and we all know this, that in the epics and in the Puranas, whenever somebody goes hunting, usually some disaster.
It's always whenever a king enters the forest, it's a sign. Yeah. Buckle up.
Hunting for sport, particularly by kings and rich people.
Particularly,
hunting for food, and hunting poor people hunting for food is different from rich people hunting just for fun. And they usually end up killing some human or some human they thought was an animal or whatever. And that shows, I think, the common vulnerability of all beings. You think it's okay to kill one vulnerable being, why not another? And then what results from that, right? And fascinating considerations of this from three people of different varnas. Bhishma, from the perspective of a kshatriya who comes from a meat-eating hunting group and is considering the whole idea of giving up eating flesh and how difficult that is for somebody who's used to the taste, because he says it's the most tasty, it's the most nourishing, etc. He says that, but if you give it up, you are becoming like the mother and the father of all living beings. And it's this very moving sort of statements that he makes, which is if you do that, that dharma is equal to all other dharmas. I mean, it's like dharma of 100 years and so on. He gives this very hyperbolical thing. And then he makes this very interesting thing, which I think is still, you can still see it in practice, which has always fascinated me, which is that more important than even than being a vegetarian, I think, is the fact that in India, most people, and I include even here many non-Hindus and non-Jains, do not eat as much meat as people in other countries do. And there are various reasons for this. One is that the diet is a very mixed and balanced one. You have dal, you have vegetables, you have so many things. So you're eating small amounts of meat relatively. India still consumes, and I quote the statistics here, much less meat than other countries like China and so on, who have comparable populations, other land spaces. And the other reason is one that Bhishma gives, because he says you should only eat the meat of sacrificed animals. Now, how often can you eat and make a sacrifice? And then he says, or if you do that, or you shouldn't eat meat during the 4 months of that. He gives some particular times, the month which is now called Navaratri. You shouldn't eat in that month. You shouldn't eat on these days. And we know that every family, I notice people, different families and communities, somebody doesn't eat meat on Sundays and Wednesdays. Somebody doesn't eat meat on Tuesdays. I mean, people have different days when they don't eat, and therefore various reasons they're not eating it. So it ends up in eating much less, is my point, much less flesh is eaten, because there is this consideration and this concern, and basic the sort of default position is that it is better not to eat it. And this is Bhishma's position, but that's also the same position which is argued by two other characters, one from a so-called Shudravarna and one from a so-called Vaishyavarna. So both of them argue that. So from different perspectives and in different, the Vaishya is much more extreme than Bhishma is. He says that it should not be eaten at all. And he also talks about other kinds of cruelty to animals in great detail, overworking them, etc.
We touched on the final chapter earlier in the podcast. Maybe you could say a word or two about famous interpreters of the epics. What do you say in the last chapter?
I talk about Kabir. I talk about throughout because Kabir is well known to many people. But I also talk here about Tulsidas, and I quote Rahim and Ravidas at some length, and also Mirabai briefly. One thing that they when they talk about justice, for instance, Ravidas, when he talks about justice and he critiques Varna and so on, I'm arguing that some of this, a good deal of this, is drawn from the Puranas and the epics. It's kind of obvious, but many people don't quite realize that, and they think that these are new ideas that these bhaktas are coming up with. Now, of course, the bhaktas give it a new turn and they use new language and they are referring to their own experience, etc., but they're also drawing from the categories of the past. For instance, they're all arguing, all of them are arguing that all beings have the same consciousness, the same Atman, and therefore there is no difference between them. Almost all of them make that claim. What they do is also they construct a kind of history of bhakti. So Ravidas, in one song, lists all the bhaktas, great bhaktas of the past and the present, and he mixes them all up. And in them are many characters from the Mahabharata, including Arjuna and Vidura and Krishna. You know, all these people are included there, right? And so he mixes them up with his own contemporaries and his own senior bhaktas, right? So he's basically saying that in the space of devotion, everyone is the same. And then they also make more specific arguments about in some famous songs about Vidura, as mentioned again and again, for example, Tulsidas in a lovely, the beginning of the Ramchandra says that he bows to all beings in the earth and the air, Aat Lakh Chaurasi, the various forms, 84 lakh species that are in the earth, in the air, in the water. He bows to all of them, knowing that they're all Siya Ramamaya Sab Jagajani, Karu Pranam Jori Jugapani, right? So he bows to all of them, knowing that they're all full of Sita and Ram. They're all pervaded by Sita and Ram. So all the bhaktas have this emphasis again on kindness to animals. It's very often, it's not noticed as much as it should be. They all talk about it. All of them talk about that.
Do you adopt a literary lens throughout your analysis?
Yes, I think I do. I'm a literary studies scholar by trainings in literary studies. So yes, I look at the way tropes are used, the way tropes recur, and I look at the turn of the way language is used, and those sorts of things, yes.
Who do you think would most benefit from the book, looking at the book? What sorts of folks, scholars?
I think general readers. I hope general readers. And then as far as who may not have read the whole text and therefore could find out here something new. Like I found out new things. And so find, like for instance, this whole debate about milking cows, for example, was a new thing to me, right? So finding that who may find some new things and that they didn't know existed in the epics. That's one in the epics and in the bhaktas maybe too. So that's one set of readers that I hope will, I hope they won't be put off by it being, you know, looking like an academic book, but it's written, as I said, in very simple language. And I put most of the secondary sources into the footnotes so that, you know, you can read them if you want, or you can go into all the details of those scholarly debates if you want, but not if you don't want. And then the other, as far as scholars are concerned, I think all those who are involved in the debates around gender, in the debates around Varna, and gender, sexuality, Varna, and other sorts of debates, like about Krishna and Yudhishthira and Arjuna and Yudhishthira and that sort of thing. So it might be interesting, yeah.
Fascinating. Was there anything else about the book that you hoped we touch on today?
No, I think we've covered it pretty well.
Excellent. Thank you very much for appearing today.
Thank you. Thanks for asking.
For those of you listening, we've of course been speaking with Dr. Ruth Vanita on a brand new OUP publication, The Dharma of Justice in the Sanskrit Epics, Debates on Gender, Varna, and Species. Until next time, keep well, keep listening, keep reading, and keep contemplating the relevance of the Mahabharata across space and time. Take care.